Obituary of History is brought to you by Audible.com.
You can get your free audiobook and start a free trial by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Hello.
Hi, guys.
And welcome to week 24 of
The Bitchery of History.
My name's Max.
I'm Allison.
And this week, I'm going to be talking about Rigoberta Menchú Tum.
I am so excited. You've told me absolutely nothing about her. So I'm going in cold.
You should be excited. She's a Nobel Prize laureate.
Ooh. Mm. I am going to be talking about Lyudmila Pavlichenko.
Fantastic.
I went back to Russia because these Russian ladies are just totally... Yeah.
There's something in the water in Russia.
Crushing it.
Absolutely.
So Lyudmila Pavlichenko was born July 12th, 1916 in a small town in Ukraine. She was reported to be unruly in school as a young girl.
Same.
Right. Her family moved to Kiev, and it was there that she heard a neighbor's son boasting about how good he was at shooting as part of the Volunteer Society for Cooperation with the Army, Aviation, and Fleet. That would be the English translation because the Russian is like beyond my scope.
And probably not a single vowel.
No, actually, it's several vowels, but it's one word.
So, it's like Finnish where they just
stick everything together. Or Welsh.
Oh, God, yes.
If you've heard Hannah speak Welsh.
I have,
Like, I'm sorry, how many words was that? Because I've only heard one.
It's like Rexachorocophalobatorian from Doctor Who.
So it's the Volunteer Society for, basically, it's the young people's sporting paramilitary club.
Oh, okay.
In Russia.
Okay.
And...
the young people's sporting... paramilitary club.
Exactly. This is Russia. This is Russia in what, the 1920s? Come on. So she heard this young boy boasting about how good he was at shooting.
Uh-huh.
And she said, quote, "I set out to show that a girl could do as well. So I practice a lot."
I love it.
And she became really quite good. She grew up. She began attending the Kiev University studying history. But on June 22nd, 1941, her life and all of Russia was turned totally upside down because the Nazis invaded.
Right.
And not one to be left out and, you know, feeling very Russian and eager to do her patriotic duty, Pavlichenko rushed to join the army.
Love it.
And she was initially denied, of course, due to her gender.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that apparently they thought she looked too much like a model. She had her nails manicured and super nice hair, and they're like, no. Even when she pulled out her sharpshooter certificate from the Young People's Paramilitary Sporting Program, they still denied her. They denied her a couple of times. Finally, they took her out kind of on an audition, in a way, where... two soldiers took her down to a range and they pointed out these other two soldiers way down and said, "Those are Nazi collaborators. What are you going to do?" She killed them. No hesitation. Dead shot through the head. Kill shot. Two of them totally taken down. Okay. So then they let her join the army.
Right.
Okay. They were like, okay, great.
Right.
In her first 75 days as a Russian sniper... she racked up 187 confirmed kills. That is why...
in the first how many days?
75 days.
Great. Mm-hmm.
So that's what? Like two a day?
Just about.
Basically? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, 187 is slang for murder or kill shot to the head. I mean, Snoop Dogg has a song with those lyrics.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
It's also the LAPD code for... homicide.
187? Jesus.
I don't know if that's why. I'm just stating some facts.
Like, what's the chance that it's not?
So snipers in these battles, they fought between the enemy lines, often super far from their companies.
Right.
It was obviously extremely dangerous and careful work. She had to sit perfectly still, like, in a tree for 8 hours and not move. So after making a name for herself in Odessa and Moldova, Pavlichenko was moved to Crimea to fight in the Battle of Sevastopol.
Okay.
Her reputation earned her more and more dangerous assignments, eventually facing off one-on-one with enemy snipers. The Smithsonian actually reports that she dueled and killed 36 enemy snipers.
36 other snipers?
Some of whom were highly decorated themselves.
Good lord.
She's quoted as just saying, "That was one of the tensest experiences of my life."
Oh my god.
Russian understatement of right. the year.
Right.
Like, yes, I sat in a tree in frozen Russia for 12 hours. It was slightly uncomfortable.
I had to wipe my brow.
Right. She was wounded 4 times, promoted to major, and became so fearsome that the Germans actually tried to talk her into defecting to them over a loudspeaker by offering her candy. I know.
Any particular kind of candy?
I don't know, but I just... You know I want all these things to be a movie, and I just want a scene of some badass Russian chick stuck up in a tree, and these Germans, like Ray Fiennes on a bullhorn, going, "We have peppermints, we have butterscotch."
It's like they just ran out of ideas. Like,
right?
I've got,
There's some chocolate.
I've got candy.
Do you want, like, just defend to being, to the Germans, and we'll give you some nougat. Like, how is that for a fair trade? Why this is not in an Indiana Jones movie at this point is beyond me.
Part of me, there's a small part of me that has to think, like, the Germans... Like, that was just their way of rationalizing, like, oh, she's Russian. Maybe she's never had candy. Like, that's just... It's, like, such a strong draw for a Russian.
In Soviet Russia, candy eat you.
Right.
She became the first Soviet soldier to visit the White House, where she met FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt. She went on a speaking tour with Eleanor Roosevelt across the country, but she became angry with all the sexist questions she was getting asked.
Welcome to America.
Right? Her look and dress were criticized. When asked if she wore makeup to battle, she responded, quote, "There is no rule against it, but who has time to think of her shiny nose when a battle is going on?"
Seriously, what kind of question is that?
She said, quote, "I wear my uniform with honor. It has the Order of Lenin on it. It has been covered with blood in battle. It is plain to see that with American women, what is important is whether they wear silk underwear under their uniforms. What the uniform stands for, they have yet to learn." End quote. Ugh. Just capital Ugh.
Good lord.
She was eventually badly wounded when shrapnel exploded in her face and was removed from active duty. She then became a sniper instructor for the Red Army instead, of course.
Of course she did.
Here is a list of all the awards and medals that she received. She was given the Order of Lenin 2x.
Dang.
Hero of the Soviet Union, Medal for Battle Merit, Medal for the Defense of Odessa, Medal for the Defense of Sevastopol, Medal for the Victory over Germany in the Great Patriotic War 1941 to 1945. Now, her final score is of confirmed kills. A confirmed sniper kill has to be verified by a third party. So right. It is likely that this number is higher because she was by herself.
Right. Exactly.
But her number of confirmed kills is 309.
Good lord.
This likely places her within the top 5 snipers of all time. Top 5 of all time.
Yeah. She's got my vote.
After the war, actually, she just returned to Kiev University, got her master's in history, and then got a job as a military historian working for the Soviet Defense Ministry. I've never wanted to go to Russia so badly in my life.
I would love to go to Russia. I've heard so many things about St. Petersburg.
Let's go.
I would love to.
All right.
All right.
So tell me about this Nobel laureate.
So this Nobel laureate... It's not a happy story. It has a redemptive. It's a redemptive story.
Okay.
But it is not a happy story. So Rigoberta Menchutum was born January 9th, 1959 in Chimel, Guatemala, which is in like the northeast province.
Okay.
She was born into an indigenous people called Quiche or Quiche, which is a branch of the Mayan civilization.
Nice.
That can actually trace its roots back to the discovery, quote unquote, of... Mexico by Columbus. Wow. And discovery of the New World. They actually traced their way all the way back, and they're known to this day as one of the indigenous peoples of Guatemala.
Cool.
And she's born in 1959, and it's important to know that starting from 1950 mm-hmm. to about 1996, mm-hmm. which when they signed the peace accords, there's a civil war going on.
Okay.
And it's essentially the powerful, the rich and powerful, right. suppressing everyone else.
Hashtag all civil wars.
Exactly. But
okay.
bloody,
yeah,
merciless. Her people were forced in the summertime from their homelands to the coasts to farm for the wealthy people. And early in her life, she becomes involved in social reform activities with the Catholic Church. She joins the women's movement to try and improve the lot of women in her area.
Yeah.
But Guatemala and the people in power were very suspicious, I mean, obviously, of people joining these reform activities.
Right.
And they were accused, or her family was accused, of taking part in the guerrilla activities that were fighting the people in power. And her father was actually arrested and tortured for a while before being released back to the family. And once the father was released, they did go and join a rebel group called the Committee of the Peasant Union, or known as the CUC, because it's a different language.
Right.
In 1979, so she's born in 1959,
right.
they join these rebel groups, they start fighting for their people, for their homeland. In 1979, her brother is tortured and killed by the Guatemalan army. 1980, her father is killed along with others when security forces storm the Spanish embassy that they'd been staying in. It's this moment called known as the burning of the Spanish embassy.
Okay.
When the Guatemalan security forces rush the compound and they kill a bunch of people. And her father is one of those people. Later that same year, her mother is arrested, tortured, raped, and then dies after they release her. And she dies from her wounds afterwards. And so by the time she's 20, I mean, her family is essentially gone. And so she throws herself into her work with the CUC. And it's an interesting, you know, as we talk about these women and we talk about people fighting against oppressors, and almost every single time that an oppressive force tries to root out a people or tries to destroy a people, it does nothing but increase the resolve. It does nothing but strengthen the opposition.
Absolutely.
There's this great West Wing episode, to go on a little tangent, called Isaac and Ishmael. And it's the episode that came out right after September 11th. It's this whole episode about extremism and terrorism.
Mm.
And they talk at one point about how terrorists never win. And they might cause damage, and they might cause sorrow, and they might cause a lot of pain.
Right.
But they never win, because it does nothing but increase the resolve of the people who are fighting and the people who are trying to receive their independence.
Right.
In 1981, so the year after her mother and father died, 2 years after her brother died, she goes into hiding in Guatemala and then flees to Mexico, which was a very common practice at this time.
Right.
During the Civil War, somewhere between like 10 and 20,000 Guatemalan indigenous people flee to Mexico. And she co-founds a group, an opposition group called the United Republic of Guatemalan Opposition, which is dedicated to fighting oppression and advocating for native rights, for indigenous people's rights. In 1982, she narrates a book to a Venezuelan author and anthropologist named Elizabeth Burgos de Bray called Me Llamo Rigoberta Menchú y Así Me Nació La Consenencia. I don't know if that last word's right, but in English it translates to My name is Rigoberto Menchú, and this is how my conscience was born. In English, the book was almost automatically translated into 5 different languages. And in English, it's known as I, Rigoberto Menchú. And it brought considerable acclaim and international fame. And almost overnight, she becomes very famous. Now, this book is not entirely, it's a little exaggerated, I should say. There's another book that comes out a little later that kind of does an unfortunate hatchet job on this author. So, like, she talks about in the book being present at her brother's execution.
Yeah.
She talks about witnessing her brother being burned alive in, like, the town square. And it comes out later that there were records kept, and there's a lot of stories kept, and there was never anyone burned in any town squares up where she was from. But the author came out afterwards and said, look, her brother may not have been burned, but he was tortured and killed and executed by the same people. So, like, even though it's a little exaggerated, the event still took place. Like, the main story is right. And so from 1982, she becomes this international figure. She starts fighting for the same thing that she's been fighting this entire time. Right. Only now she's on a national stage. In 1986, she becomes a member of the National Coordinating Committee for the CUC. So she starts helping to direct the fight against the Civil War. In 1992, she wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And they give it to her for in recognition of her work for social justice and ethno-cultural reconciliation based on respect for the rights of indigenous peoples. And then in 1996, she serves as the presidential goodwill ambassador for the peace accords that end the civil war in Guatemala.
That's amazing.
It does, a redemptive story. So since then, she's still alive to this day. Since then, she's been active in trying to bring those who committed the atrocities in Guatemala to justice. The most recent one was in January of 2015. One of the commanders of the raid that killed her father at the Spanish embassy was sentenced in a Spanish court for crimes against humanity. And she had a hand in bringing that about.
That's great.
She helped found several groups aimed at peace, including the Nobel Women's Initiative, which helps to strengthen the work being done in support of women's rights around the world. She ran for president of Guatemala twice in 2007 and 2011. She came in sixth out of 13 in 2007. In 2011, she ran, but she didn't win enough to make past the first round, but she was able to become a candidate. She is a member of Peace Jam, which is a group that Nobel laureates in general put on that helps to inspire the youth by connecting Nobel laureates to youth around the world in order to inspire the next generation.
That's so cool.
And then she was also a founding member of the Chirac's Honor Committee, which was founded by Jacques Chirac, the former president of France, which helps to promote world peace since its inception in 2008.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and she's still alive today. She's still fighting that good fight.
Keep going.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's Rigoberta Menchú.
She's an amazing woman. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah.
I really love when you or I, but when we find women from all over that I don't know anything about.
I had never heard of her before. And I felt it was time for us to go back to South America because it's been a little bit since we've had...
We haven't done nearly enough over there.
And
it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Hey guys, let's take a little break and talk to you about our sponsors at audible.com.
This week, I want to talk about one of my favorite authors. She's a woman. She has a new show on Netflix. She is Chelsea Handler.
Woo!
And actually, a lot of her books are available, almost all of them, and she narrates all of them, too.
Hey!
The one in particular that I want to talk about is called Are You There, Vodka? It's me, Chelsea.
Speaking of vodka.
And I love it so much because she talks about... I actually see a lot of myself in her because she's a very, like, outspoken woman. She speaks her mind, and she's very, like, firm in what she believes. But at the same time, she's open to learning new experiences. In fact, this show that she has now on Netflix is all about her learning things. She has people on, and they talk about learning new things and new experiences and stuff like that. And Are You There, Vodka? It's Me, Chelsea is really just, I mean, every one of her books is like a snippet of her life. Her most recent one is called Uganda, Be Kidding Me. And it's about her trip to Uganda and about her travels on safari with her friends and all that kind of stuff. And it's really just kind of like how I want to live my life. It's just making art and doing things with my friends and traveling the world and getting paid for it. Because really, I mean, what else could there be?
Awesome.
You know what I mean?
Well, making the world a better place.
Well, yes.
But in the meantime.
Absolutely. I think I can do both. I think we can travel the world and have fun and change the world.
And while we're traveling, we can listen to audiobooks.
Absolutely.
We can get that one and many others by going to audibletrial.com/bitchery.
Yes. All right. So today in history.
Yes.
So we have three, like normal.
So on July 11th, 1874, Augusta Jane Chapin performed a wedding in San Francisco. Probably the first wedding performed on the Pacific Coast by an ordained woman minister.
Nice.
Nice.
On July 13th, 1979, the Women's History Summer Institute at Sarah Lawrence College started a symposium which lasted from the 13th to the 29th and led to the founding of Women's History Month.
Hey!
Heyo!
That's awesome.
And I thought the third one you should read.
Oh, perfect. Oh, on July 12th, 1972, Shirley Chisholm comes in fourth in the first ballot at the Democratic National Convention. She was the first black woman to seriously vie for a presidential nomination by a major U.S. political party. She's awesome.
Bringing it around.
Love it.
All right. So what's our term for this week,
Allison? Term of the week, we're just going to talk generally about eating disorders.
Okay.
Because I think a lot of people have the idea that it affects women most significantly. And they are right, although men, of course, also can have and suffer from eating disorders.
And do suffer from them.
Absolutely. But I just wanted to talk about it kind of the way that we talked about period. I think, in a way, it's a mental health issue that is largely ignored in society and not talked about nearly enough.
Absolutely.
And it's something that I have personally struggled with in my life. That really no one knows. Yeah. My family knows, but I told you just like right before we did this podcast, I said I want to talk about it.
Thank you for
it's important
that with
to me.
By the way.
Yeah, thanks for accepting. I don't know, for listening, for understanding.
I've just always gotten into the habit of when people share personal things with me, and this is also my thing when people come out to me.
Yeah,
it's always a thank you for sharing. Thank
no,
you for
I really like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, most people don't know that about me, but it's something that I struggled with. And I think to this day, I still struggle with it sometimes. So I just have some general statistics on eating disorders that I was going to share.
Okay.
They are a daily struggle for 10 million females and 1 million males in the United States.
So that's a good 10% of the population. At least in America.
Yes. 4 out of 10 individuals have either personally experienced an eating disorder or know someone who has. Female eating disorder prevalence rates are as follows. 0.9% of women will struggle with anorexia. 1.5% will struggle with bulimia. 3.5% will struggle with binge eating. The average American woman is 5'4" tall and weighs about 165 pounds. The average Miss America winner is 5'7" and weighs 121 pounds. Just to put things in perspective. Yeah.
And I think I found this from the National Institutes of Mental Health. And the official definition of an eating disorder is, eating disorders are serious and often fatal illnesses that cause severe disturbances to a person's eating behaviors. Obsessions with food, body weight, and shape may also signal an eating disorder. Common eating disorders including anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and binge eating disorder. Commonly held that eating disorders are a lifestyle choice, and they're not. No. A lot of times eating disorders are influenced by the very things that we've been talking about on this podcast.
Right.
I talked about toxic masculinity is what feeds a lot of male eating disorders. And eating disorders are not just starving yourself. It's not just throwing up and binging. It's also bulking. And it's also working out to the point where you're so muscly and you're so this that you can't move. And there are healthy ways to gain muscle. And there are healthy ways to get fit that aren't, you know, killing yourself or working yourself to the bone. And I think a lot of the female eating disorders are fed by this kind of vicious cycle of, you know, what a woman is supposed to look like in magazines.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's even the statistics for the average Miss America winner. It's this ideal that beautiful is tall and thin and probably blonde-haired and blue-eyed as well. And I think, too, what I would want to say is that anyone can struggle with an eating disorder because when I was growing up, I never thought that that would be something that I would ever have an issue with. And it's not always an issue of, oh, I want to look beautiful, oh, I need to look thin, I need to look like all the girls on the magazines. It is also, it is a mental health issue, but it can be a control issue as well, because that's when it started for me, when I realized, hey, there are things in my life that I can't control. And I didn't even consciously realize that that then was feeding into, well, I can control what I'm eating, so therefore I'm going to control that and bring right. some semblance Absolutely. Of an illusion of control into Absolutely. My life. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just important to remember that it's not just about looking beautiful, and they'll always manifest in different ways. Mm-hmm. But if it's something that you are struggling with, anyone who's listening, it's okay, and you should talk to someone, mm-hmm. and you should get help, because mm-hmm. you're not alone.
Absolutely.
I think that's all I want to say. We can end it there.
Absolutely. All right. Well, if you'd like to keep in contact with us, you can do so at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/umpboh.
You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram using the same handles.
If you'd like to support us and get some behind-the-scenes feedback, you can do that at patreon.com/ursulamajor. You can support us for $1 a day, $2 a day, or, hey, I don't know, 50 cents a podcast. Whatever you're able to do, anything helps, honestly.
The best thing, as always, if you want to subscribe on Stitcher, iTunes, Podomatic, Google Play, wherever you're listening to your podcast, leave us a review or give us a rating. That helps other people find the podcast, which helps us keep doing the podcast and bringing you more great stories.
The Bitchy of History is a production of Ursula Major Productions, hosted by yours truly and Allison Powell, associate producer Chris McNeil, intern Katie Chang, and contributors Ella Moore and Grace Seaman.
And as always, bitches get stuff done.
Hey y'all, if you're enjoying the podcast, it would really be a great favor to Allison and I if you would go and give us a rating or a comment on iTunes. Like Allison said, those ratings and comments, they help other people find the show, which help us keep doing the show. Thanks.